Well, good evening. You know, the last several months, there's kind of something Corey said multiple times during his lessons. He says, I'm going to talk about me because it's easier. And tonight I'm going to ask you to bear with me because I'm going to talk about me, but it ain't going to be easier. But Sarah and I'm going to put her in on this because she's back there, have decided that if I can talk about my story, then maybe we can keep somebody else from making the decisions that I made and your family from having to go through what my family went through. So we're going to have a difficult conversation tonight, and you guys are going to be along for the ride, but hopefully we'll learn something from it. Talking about your past, there's biblical examples of that, and Josh alluded to that in class today. Paul talked about it numerous times in Acts 22, 1 Timothy 1, Galatians 1, was all times that Paul talked about his past when he was in front of a group of people. And why exactly he did that, I think there could be multiple reasons, but one is there had to be a big elephant in the room when Paul stood up in front of somebody. Probably like the big elephant that's in the room tonight when I stand in front of each of you guys. And it's good to know that back then that Paul was human too and made mistakes, and I'm sure he was able to relate with people because of his mistakes. And it gave him something to talk about. So Paul never glorified his past sins. He never bragged about it. He never boasted about it. But he never hid from it. He just talked about it. And that's what we're going to do tonight. Most everybody knows because you were around for the ride, but 7 years ago I left my family, committed adultery, and decided that I was going to more or less go live a different life. And it's been a long 7 years to get to where I am in front of you standing here today, but I made it. So we're going to talk about it tonight, and again, I think everybody will hopefully learn something from it. The first thing that I'm going to tell you what I did, and hopefully if it applies, you can make some application to your life. But the first thing that I did where I was wrong was I told myself that this can't happen to me. And I can promise you that most of you tonight are sitting here in the auditorium tonight saying that I will never commit adultery and leave my family. And that may be true. But there are a lot of other sins out there besides adultery that can cause us to fall away from the church. And those are the things we have to think about. I can remember whenever I was teaching class up here, and we were all teaching people our own age. So, Josh and all of them were in this class, and I had done a lesson up here one day where it said that one out of six people, they're saying, are at the time in the Church of Christ will fall away. And I don't remember how many were in the class, but I remember thinking, you know, that one and a half of us in this class are going to fall away statistically. But of course, I knew it wasn't going to be me. And that's just not what happened. I was the one. Now they're estimating in the Church of Christ that around 33% of the church will walk away from it. So when you turn around, when Jordan does kids sing tonight, and I know we're missing some of our kids, but you can count 22 or 23 kids up here. I'm not great at math, but 30% of them is a lot. But the fact of the matter is it's not just kids that are leaving the church. Several adults along the way are leaving the church. And you don't have to think very hard to think about some very sound at one time gospel preachers within a 100-mile radius of here that for whatever reason decided they were going to leave the church, mainly because whatever actions they wanted to live didn't align. So the first thing that we all have to understand is it can happen to any of us. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 12, therefore it says, therefore let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he falls. It's just a verse that we read all the time, but I don't think we really let it sink in. And he's trying to warn that take heed, because there's a chance that you could fall. And that's what I did. So the first thing we have to recognize is that it can happen to any of us. The other thing that I know led me to take the path that I took started several years before I ever committed adultery. And that is, along the way, started finding some success. You know, I found a lot of success in high school, and then I entered the workforce, and I was successful at my job. And because of my success, I was able to quickly climb the chain. And while doing that, and you think everything's going good, I become a very arrogant person. I was just prideful. I was just arrogant. I mean, you probably all recognized that back then. I didn't recognize it at the time, but I just thought I was pretty good. And no doubt people that I work with had to think that. And I just started seeing all these things that I had accomplished and just started thinking how good I was. And there's a big problem with this, because the more I thought that I did, the less I recognized what God was doing. And the more that happens, the more you think you need less of God because you don't really need Him, because you're doing it all yourself. And it makes me think about that song that we sing a lot, none of self and all of thee. And it starts out with all of self and none of thee, and then some of self and some of thee, and less of self and more of thee, and then none of self and all of thee. And there was a long period in my life, probably 5 to 10 years, when it was all of self and none of thee. I just gave God no credit for the success and the blessings in my life, and I probably said the word I thousands of times in the day. And when you start feeling that arrogant about yourself, you start to push God out. And when you start to push God out, it really starts to create a lot of problems, because you rely on Him less, you study about Him less, you listen about Him less, because you just don't think you need Him. Because there's nothing God can do that I can't do myself. Now, that may not be what we're thinking at the time, but that's the truth of the matter. One of the worst decisions that I ever made was the time that I was offered a big promotion at Pennington to join the senior leadership team. And that really, that single decision that I made catapulted me into a life that I will have to live the rest of my life. And that seems like an innocent deal, and we're going to talk more about that later. But when I took that job, it paid more and stuff, but I didn't take it for the money. I took it because I was arrogant and because I wanted to tell everybody how successful I was. I'd like to think that it was for the money, but it wasn't. I took that position because I wanted to brag that I was now on the senior leadership team. And by doing so, it put me in an airport, a hotel, gone all the time, away from church, away from my family. And that one decision is one that I will always look back on and regret making. Because had I not taken that job, had I not taken that promotion, and I just took it for one reason, because I wanted everybody to know how good I was. And if I wouldn't have taken that one job, then there's no doubt how differently my life could have been today. The Bible spends a lot of time talking about a prideful person, and there's a reason for that. There's a reason that God warns us all the time about pride, and that is the reason, because we are nothing without God. And the minute we start to think that we are, and we start to push Him out of our lives, it allows everything else to come in. And I know that that's something that I was like that for years before I ever fell away. In Proverbs chapter 16, verse 18, it says, "Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall." In Proverbs 11, verse 2, it spends about 6 verses kind of drawing a contradiction between two things. But then in verse 2, it says, "When pride comes, then comes shame, but with humble is wisdom." It's really interesting when these two verses, because when it talks about what happens after pride, it doesn't say, after pride, this may happen. Did you recognize that? It says, with pride, this happens. It's guaranteed. You know, sometimes in the Bible, like, if you do this, it could lead to this. But it's very specific. Pride goes before destruction. So if you're prideful, what's coming? Destruction. Proverbs 11, verse 2, "When pride comes, then comes shame." There's no other option. There's no way to be prideful without it coming with shame. And I can promise you that. It's very matter of fact. So this is something, the word pride is something that we have to think about often. In James chapter 4, verse 6, it says, God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. There's just no room in God's church to be prideful. And that's something that I think all of us have to think about. Anytime we think we've done something, we need to really think hard about who actually did it. We can't be prideful, we can't be arrogant, because truly we are nothing without God. And I know one of the first mistakes I made long ago, after I didn't think it could happen to me, was I became an arrogant person. A person that when I look back on some of the things I did and the way I treated people, I'm pretty ashamed of. It's interesting enough, because had I read Proverbs, I would have known that after pride comes shame. The next thing I'd like to look at, and we'll spend quite a bit of our time here, is I'm going to say I was ignorant, but probably a better word is just stupid on how the devil actually works. And we talk about how the devil works all the time, but do we really stop and think about how he truly works? Because I think I was pretty ignorant in the fact of how he honestly works. If I were to ask you what our job as Christians are, I think most of us would probably say to seek and save the lost. That's our job of Christians, right? What do you think the job of the devil is? To seek and destroy the saved. Now, I'm not God and I don't get to judge people, but the Bible tells us that narrow is the way and few will find it that leads to heaven. So how many people do you think in the world that the devil is really concerned about right now? I hadn't really thought about it until I really got to thinking about how the devil works. You think he's concerned in some of these, in Haiti, where all those gangs are just going crazy and destroying that country? He's done one there. Where do you think the devil's working? Right here. Right here. And the Bible tells us there's not a lot of people going to heaven. It's a small gate. It's few will find it. So his numbers aren't big. He can be very focused and deliberate on the work that he does. And I think that's something that we have to keep in mind. God wants us, or Satan wants us. How much do you think Satan rejoiced when he pulled a deacon from the Church of Christ in Bonham, Missouri? It's probably a big day for the devil, wasn't it? Big day for the devil. I can only imagine how much he rejoiced when he was able to do that. It's pretty sickening when you think about it, but that's what he's doing. That's his job. I think that's something that we have to keep in mind. In 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8, if you'd like to turn there, it says in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8, be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Now, when we hear this word roaring, we think that it's a loud lion. Well, that's not how a lion works. But when you read this verse, it's easy to think about when a lion roars. That's not how a lion attacks its prey. I've never seen a lion coming across a prairie somewhere, a desert, just roaring as loud as he can, trying to eat something. So that's just not how he works. And it warns us here. This is a great analogy of how the devil works. But it says we must be sober. Now, when we hear the word sober, we think not drunk. But that word sober means more things. It means to have clarity of the mind. Be vigilant means we have to be watchful. So we've got a clear mind and we have to be looking for the devil. But I know we've all watched those Animal Planet videos from time to time and seen how a lion hunts its prey. I mean, a lion will get as low as it can to the ground and sneak as quietly as it can, as slow as it has to, and be as patient as it has to get the prey. I just Googled here when I was putting this together, how does a lion hunt? And this was the first answer. Lions are patient predators, often waiting in cover until they can get close enough to their prey. That's how the devil works. He's patient. He's patient. He worked on me for years, of me being prideful, of me, these opportunities that I threw, and all these things. He worked on me for years before he could jump out and get me. There may be people in the auditorium tonight, and I know all of us would agree to this, that he's working on you right now. Hopefully you recognize it. The scary thing is if you don't recognize it, because he is. He's patient. That's how he works. If you'll turn to Genesis chapter 3, we're going to read a few verses here. When we're going to read about the first sin, and we can learn a lot from this. In Genesis chapter 3, verse 1, "Now the serpent was more cunning than any beast of the field which the Lord God made. And he said to the woman, Has God indeed said, You shall not eat of the tree, not eat of every tree of the garden?" There's a lot we can learn from this one verse. The first thing we have to recognize is that word cunning. That word cunning. If you just look up the definition, it's having a skill in achieving one's ends by deceit or invasion. So you think the devil's afraid to lie to you? You think the devil's afraid to paint you a picture what the grass looks like on the other side that's not actually what the grass looks like on the other side? No, that's how he works. He's cunning. But it's interesting to me to note what he told Eve. He told Eve what she shouldn't be doing, which is pretty interesting because that means the devil knew what God had told Adam and Eve they couldn't do. You think God, or you think Satan knows what God has told us we can and cannot do? Yeah, he knows it pretty well. He uses that. Verse 2, "And the woman said to the serpent, We may eat the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God has said, You shall not eat it, nor shall you touch it, lest you die." Did Eve know what she wasn't supposed to do? Oh, Eve knew. Eve knew. She knew exactly what she was supposed to, what God had commanded her to do. She quoted it. There was no doubt in her mind what she wasn't supposed to do. Do you think that I knew that adultery was wrong? Of course I did. Do you think Eve knew what was wrong here? Of course she did. Let's pick it up there in verse 4. "Then the serpent said to the woman, You will not surely die. For God knows that in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be open, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." Let's look at the progression that the devil made. Satan knew what they weren't supposed to do. Satan verified that Eve knew what she wasn't supposed to do. But then he used deceit to be cunning to make her question God's commandments, and it worked. Satan uses our weaknesses, our temptations, along with lies and deceit to convince us that we should go against God's will. That's the same thing he done to Eve in the very beginning of creation is the exact same thing that he does to each one of us. It's exactly what he did to me. In James chapter 1, if you turn over to James chapter 1, we learn a little bit about how the Satan's temptations work. And starting there in verse 14, it says, "But each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Then when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death." What we read about in James is word for word, when you think about it, what we read in Genesis chapter 3 when we were looking at Adam and Eve. It's interesting that it says that, "But each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticements." That word "own" there is extremely important. Because there are certain things that may have tempted me that don't tempt you. You think the devil knows that? There are certain things that may tempt you that don't tempt me. But Satan is going to use a customary plan to do whatever it takes for your own desires. Not my desires. He's going after what entices you. Now, we've got a lot of good people in the auditorium tonight, but I know that there are certain things that each of us may struggle with. Satan knows that, and that's where he's aiming. Whatever it is, if it's anger, if it's gossip, if it's covetousness, if it's a lack of faith, if it's pornography, whatever it is, Satan knows. And that's where he's shooting. And once we allow that to stir inside our bodies and we don't get away from it, we don't walk away from it, just as James says, it's conceived just like a baby. It grows within us. And then it gives birth to sin. Eve was enticed by her own desire to be as smart as God. She didn't walk away. She could have turned and walked away, but she didn't turn and walk away. She didn't get out of the situation when she could, and she'd allowed her desire to give birth to sin. It's exactly what happened to me. I had multiple opportunities to walk away before it ever happened, and I didn't. Satan was patient. He just kept hand-feeding me piece by piece. This is how the devil works. Adultery doesn't happen overnight when it comes to a Christian. It doesn't happen overnight. You don't wake up one morning and decide that you want to leave your family and commit adultery. It doesn't happen. 7 years ago when I chose to do it, there was no flashing sign that said, Brian, right here is adultery. Why would Satan have not have flashed that? Because I knew it was wrong. Just like Eve knew what was wrong. I knew it was wrong. That's not how Satan works. It doesn't just happen overnight. If you don't take anything else from tonight's lesson, I want you to remember this one thing, because it's something I tell myself all of the time. For me, it started with a Subway sandwich. It's pretty innocent, isn't it? That's one Subway sandwich I wish I never would have eaten. But there's nothing sinful about a Subway sandwich, is there? But from that moment on, it spiraled with months and months and months where finally I gave in to sin. So something that I tell myself all of the time in all of my situations is to watch for the sandwich. Watch for the sandwich. That's when you have to stop it. You have to stop and never eat the sandwich, because then you can never be conceived of the sin of the temptation from the devil, and it will never give birth to sin. So all of you, I'm warning you, in whatever it is that you struggle with, watch for the sandwich. Because if you eat the sandwich, it's a slippery slope after that. There's things I like to think about that worry me a little bit. I could probably go around and ask, there's going to be some older kids in here. And I bet I could go around and ask each and every one of you, is it wrong to have sex before marriage? Is fornication wrong? And I think you'd all say yes. You have all been taught since you were a young age that premarital sex is wrong. It's biblically wrong. So do you think that when you leave this building, the devil's going to be standing there with a sign that says, come have premarital sex right here? Why is he not going to flash that sign? Are any of you going to go to it? No, because you know it's wrong. But from everything we've read tonight, is that how the devil works? No. It's going to start with a kiss. Now, is it all right to kiss your boyfriend or girlfriend? Whenever your parents say, it's all right. I'm not saying it's not. But that's the Subway sandwich. It just is. And again, I'm not saying that you shouldn't kiss your boyfriend or girlfriend. But I'm warning you that that's the sandwich. Because some of you may not realize it right now, but you're going to kiss your girlfriend and your boyfriend, and you're going to like it. You're going to like it. And the next time you're going to kiss them just a little bit longer because you like it. Some of you kids are too young to know what I'm talking about, but at some point you're going to reach a stage where you like it. And then you're going to be traveling somewhere and have a little extra time to kill, and it's just going to go a little bit further, and you're going to like that. And it's going to go a little bit further, and you're going to like that. And it may take 6 months. It may take a year. But what do we know the devil is? He's patient. You think the devil's going to give up on you? No. He's going to spoon feed you these sins that you enjoy and that you like and that feel good until he wins. There's no flashing lights out there warning us about sin. It's not how the devil works. And we've talked a lot of things about sexual things tonight. Those aren't the only sins. There's a lot more sins talked about in the Bible. So whatever it is that you struggle with, you know it. Each one of you know what it is, the one thing that you struggle with. If it's anger, do you think there's a sign standing out there that says, get mad and take God's name in vain? No. You think do all of us know that it's wrong to take the Lord's name in vain? So what's he going to do? He's going to wait till you're in a hurry to get to a ball game, and he's going to put a slow person in front of you. He's going to wait till you're in a hurry and you're walking out to go to work and there's going to be a cow out. Right? And then we're going to not say the Lord's name in vain, but we're going to say another curse word. That's not good enough for the devil. He wants us to curse our Creator. So once we get that cow in, she's going to run right back out the gate and go past us again. And maybe we cuss a couple times then. You think he's done? No. He's going to give you a flat tire on the way to work. He's not going to stop. He's not going to stop. He's just going to keep going. And that's something that we have to think about. If it was as easy as looking for the flashing sign, I think we could all be all right. But it's just not how the devil works. In Genesis chapter 13, if you'd like to turn there, all of these stories hit, when I say stories, biblical accounts hit a little differently after you make the decisions that I made. But I can't help about thinking about Sodom and Gomorrah. In Genesis chapter 13, starting there in verse 10, and Lot, they're talking, you know, they're just trying to decide, Abram and Lot, who's going to go where? Pretty simple decision, right? And it's interesting to me what we read there in verse 10. And Lot lifted his eyes and saw all the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt as you go towards Zoar. Then Lot chose for himself all the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east, and they separated from each other. You think Lot regrets the decision he made? Was there anything sinful about the land that he picked? No. But he made one decision to go where it looked good. It was pleasing to the eye. You think he enjoyed when he first got there and had this bountiful, oh, it was probably pretty nice. The grass, I bet, was greener on the other side. I bet Lot was really loving the decision he made for a while, wasn't he? Didn't last, did it? It didn't last. Accounts like that in the Bible really hit home to me anymore. Because I just think of all of the decisions I could have made differently. Decisions that seemed innocent at the time. But now if you truly think about the way the devil works, it just isn't quite that way. So after I fell to adultery and was living in that sin, my heart became hardened. And this is something that I think a lot of you that were around me at the time struggled with. Because I just didn't seem right. I'm sure you thought over and over again, why will he just not pull his head out of it? Why can he just not get away from it? I'm sure it drove all of you crazy. You probably never could figure it out. We read several accounts in the Bible where it talks about someone's heart just being hardened. And in this phase, I'm going to call it of almost 2 years, because that's really about how long it went on, 18 months to 2 years, I want to talk a little bit about what those 2 years were like so that maybe we can understand that the grass isn't always greener on the other side. there's a, I won't pronounce it right, but it's a Kubler-Ross model. And it's just a proven, it's a proven model of things that we all go through, that humans go through, and it's called the grief process. And it does, we think of the word grief like someone being sorrowful, and you're thinking, why in the world were you grieving, Brian? We were the ones grieving. But it's anything when you have a change or you have difficult experiences that you go through or you have loss, there are certain ways that our bodies naturally handle the situations. There's five different phases that you go through. And I went through all of them. The first stage is denial, where there's no way this is happening to me. There's just no way. This can't be happening to me. The next stage is anger. I spent a lot of time here. We're going to come back to a little bit. The third stage is bargaining. And these three stages out of the five stages, I'm going to say took me about a year to get through. And that's the year where we were all, because I say we all because I know you all were a part of it. We were on a roller coaster. And you guys will remember the roller coaster that we all went on together. And it's because once you're on these stages, you shift back and forth between all of them. And in that time frame, you make a different decision every day. Because sometimes you're in denial, sometimes you're mad, and sometimes you're trying to bargain with people and God to fix it all. And it took me about a year of a roller coaster, and you all went on there with me, that we did this, that I did this. But I want to talk a little bit about the anger. I was mad. I was mad at you guys. Just being honest. My heart was hardened, and I was mad at you guys. Angry. You guys left me. Now, think about it. When I was in the situation, this is how it felt. I'm not talking about it now, so hopefully the Lord doesn't come back yet because I want to finish my train of thought. But in the moment, I was mad at you guys. You guys didn't talk to me. You didn't help me. You weren't around when I needed you. I was mad at you. I feel like you guys had left me and betrayed me, and I was here for a long time. There was a lot of hatred in my heart towards everybody, mainly my family. I was angry. So that whole thing went on about a year. And then if you guys will notice, I kind of disappeared for a year, where you guys really didn't hear me from me much or see me much. You might see me around town, but I pretty much stuck to myself. I wasn't coming back here anymore. I wasn't trying to create any problems. And at this point, you may not know, but I had actually left the sinful situation. But it took me a year, a little longer, to get out of the situation before I was ready to come back here. And I know there are a lot of you wondering, why in the world did it take so long? And the majority of that, we'll say 11 months and 29 days, was I was depressed. Bad depressed. A level of depression that I hope none of you ever have to go through. And I'll just tell you, if you've never dealt with it, depression is real. It is real. And if you aren't someone that gets depressed, I am thankful. But I was depressed. I spent months going through counseling with a guy in Springfield at my own expense because I was just struggling with life. I was just down. He wasn't a church person, but he truly helped me find myself. And I don't remember his name, but I really am thankful for him because it took a long time going and seeing the guy. But if I hadn't gotten over the anger that I had towards everyone, I never would have been able to get to where I am today. So it almost took a year, but he helped me get through it. Here's something that I didn't know until I was in the middle of it. And some of you, I hope some of you will never understand the statement I'm getting ready to make. But being at rock bottom is way better than falling to rock bottom. And that may be hard for you guys to understand, but when you fall into rock bottom, you can't go any further. So I spent at this point, a year and a half of my life, just feeling like I was falling nonstop. And when I finally hit rock bottom, it felt really good. It felt really, really good being down there because I knew I couldn't fall any further. And that year that I spent depressed and kind of out of the mind and out of the eye, away from everybody, and all of you are probably wondering, why in the world will he not just come back? It's because I was scared to leave rock bottom. Because what happens when you start to climb out of rock bottom? You could fall again. And I struggled with this for a long time. And this is something, when I was seeing my counselor in Springfield, that he finally just said, Brian, I can't, you can keep paying me to come see me, but there's nothing else I can do for you. Because you have made the decision that it's easier for you to live in rock bottom than it is for you to start to climb out of it. So as time went on and I was living here and I was struggling. I knew what I needed to do, but I was just too scared to do it. And I'll always be thankful what led me to my final step of this grief process, and that's acceptance. That's when you accept the decisions that you've made, you accept the fact of the new life that you have, and you just make peace with it. But when you're living in that depression, something I forgot to mention was, these are the things that went through my mind all the time. If I saw you guys in public when my heart was hardened and I was being disfellowshipped and you didn't talk to me, that was okay because you weren't supposed to talk to me. But what if I come forward and make everything right? What if my relationships are never the same? Right now, when I was living away from here and you guys had disfellowshipped me, Sarah wasn't going to be with me. She wasn't going to remarry me. But what if I came back? What if I came forward, made my life right, and she still didn't want to be with me? What if my relationship with all of you guys, my closest of friends and my brother and my mom and dad, what if it was never the same? Right now they have a reason not to talk to me. But those were the things that constantly went through my mind, and that's where I say that being in rock bottom was far better than trying to get out of it, because I didn't have to worry about those things. Now, this lesson tonight, it's funny how much alignment it goes with what Jordan spent this morning talking about when we look about how the way the world works. And I think we've covered all of the three things he talked about tonight. We've talked about Satan, we've talked about our own choices, and then we've talked about God's providential hand. And there's a guy that all of you know who he is, but one day I decided I was really struggling and I really wanted to get things right, but I was just too scared to start to get out of rock bottom. So I reached out to Nathan Honeycutt, and a lot of you will know Nathan. He comes here some, down at Joplin, I think is where he is. He's a counselor, member of the church, preaches a lot. And Sarah and I had actually went and saw Nathan back before everything, trying to get things, when we were in the middle of it, trying to get things worked out. And I just reached out and I said, Nathan, I'm struggling. Can I come see you? And I truly believe this was the providential hand of God, because when I was trying to explain to Nathan how I was too scared to start trying to get out of rock bottom, that I couldn't go make myself right with God, I couldn't do anything I want, he completely knew what I was going through. It was textbook, the training that he has. And I will forever be grateful for my session with Nathan Honeycutt, because this is what he said. He said, I can't promise you anything. I can't promise you anything. I can't promise you that Sarah will take you back. I can't promise you that your relationships will ever be the same. But if you'll get your life right with God, you will always have him as a safety net when you fall. That was his exact words. Brian, I can't promise you that this life that you picture is going to happen once you go forward is going to happen. But what I can promise you is that if you make yourself right with God, you'll start getting out of the hole, then, and make yourself right, God will be there as your safety net. And I think we'll all agree that that's true. So I met with him on a Sunday, and I think it was that Monday or Tuesday that I reached out to the elders and told them that I wanted to be baptized and I wanted to make things right. And 5 or so years later, here I am standing in front of you. It's been a long ride, but here we are. Never looked back. But something that I want all of us to understand is if you think it's all good every day, it's not. It's not good every day. If you think Sarah's happy with things every day, you're wrong. And rightfully so. I know we walk in here, we always sit by each other, we always put on a great face, but sin has consequences. Until the day I die, we are going to work through those consequences as a family. But I don't want you to anybody to think it's easy. I don't want you anybody to think that, oh, how in the world is everything just so great? And it's okay if I commit that sin because I can be forgiven and everything will be great. It's not great. Each day gets better. But the life we have in front of us will never be the same as the life before I made the decisions. So it's just something that I want you to keep in mind. There's a few things, there's a lot in this that I don't know, but there's two things that I've learned that I do know. And I want you, again, if you don't listen to anything else, please listen to these two things. There is a God. And I know Corey, or I think it was, or Brad was talking about the evidence and all this on Wednesday night, how we know there's a God. You want to know how I can promise you there's a God? Go 35, 36 years of your life only knowing a life with God in it, and then turn away from Him for 2 years and see what happens to your life. When the Bible talks about all things work, as Jordan talked about today, for good for those who love the Lord, what's that mean if you don't love the Lord? I have never been more certain that there is a God than I am after going 2 years without Him, because everything was bad. I could feel it. I just had this hole, even through when I was living in the sin and making terrible decisions, I had a hole that I just can't explain, and I hope none of you will know. But I know when I no longer had God with me. The other thing that I know is church discipline works. Church discipline works. If you guys would not have disfellowshipped me all the times it took, and had each and every one of you not fulfilled the role of a brother and sister who practices church discipline, and had my parents and brother and ex-wife at the time not practice that, I would not be here today. I wanted to get things right with God, but you know what I almost wanted in parts of it more than that? I wanted them back. And if I would have had them all along the way, I would have had no reason to come back. Church disfellowship works. We want to talk about the providential hand of God. Do you guys remember the series I spent months talking about on Wednesday night when we looked at the forgotten commandment in the Bible, church disfellowship? And who did you guys have to use it on? Me. Perhaps that was the providential hand of God. You guys were prepared to do what you had to do to disfellowship me, and if you hadn't, I wouldn't be here today. I just wouldn't. But in order for church disfellowship to have to work, we have to do a better job of fellowshipping with our brothers and sisters in Christ. It's the only way it works. Because if I didn't miss you guys, I wouldn't have wanted to come back to you guys. But when I see my best friend, since I was a little kid, not talk to me at a ball game, or my brother or my dad walk into the cafe and not say a word to me, it works. But had I not had those relationships with everybody beforehand, it wouldn't have worked. One day, we're all going to be in heaven together, and I'm going to be there, and you guys are going to be able to know it's because you, even though I was angry with you at the time, you disfellowshipped me. And each one of you did it perfectly to the Bibles, and for those reasons, I'm standing here tonight. There's no other way I would have been. Real quick, I know we're getting late. There's good news. In 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 13, no temptation has overtaken you except such as a common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able. But with the temptation will also make the way of escape, that you may be able to bear it. The devil's going to tempt us every single day, but we have reassurance that there is no temptation the devil can throw at us that God doesn't give us a way out. That's good news. Whatever temptations you're dealing with, each of us personal, that we probably don't all know about, there's good news. God has a way out. Find it. Find the way out and run. Run from the devil. How do we do it? Matthew chapter 26, verse 41 tells us, "Watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." Every day we have to watch. How does the devil hunt? He's right here, right now. There's no flashing lights. He is preying on us. Watch for him. Watch for the sandwich. And pray every single day that you'll have the wisdom to see the sandwich, because there's no flashing lights out there warning us of the sins in our life. In 1 John chapter 1, we'll finish here tonight. In 1 John chapter 1, verse 9, there's a lot of Bible verses that I'm pretty thankful for these days, but this is one of them. "If we confess our sins, he is faithful and just to forgive us of our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness." We talked about all of the different bad people. Josh talked about it in class out there, and all the things that Paul said he did. There's a lot of bad people in this world, but every single person can be forgiven of those sins. Every single person. And I am so thankful for that verse. I am so thankful for that verse. If there's anyone here tonight that is struggling with sin, I can relate. I can relate. I've been there. But I'm begging you to run from it, to watch for it every day, and to pray that you don't fall for it. And do not, kids, listen. Old adults, listen. Do not do what I did. Don't do it. It's not worth it. It's just not worth it. If there's anyone here tonight who is ready to be baptized, then we want to do that. If there's anyone here tonight that has sin in their life and wants the prayers, we want to fix that too. We serve a forgiving God, and I'm thankful for that, and I know each one of you guys are, and I'm thankful for each one of you guys, and I've probably not went around and personally thanked all of you, but I'm here tonight, and I'm going to be in heaven one day because of what you guys did to me, and I know it was hard on you, but thank you. If there's anyone here tonight that's struggling, they'll do the same thing for you. They'll help you get to heaven. The people around you want you to get to heaven. They wanted me to get there, and they want you to get there. We're a family, and we always need to remember that when we're struggling. So if there's anything we can help you with tonight, please come as we stand and as we pray.